Til første sesjon på det tekniske sporet I dag har vi vært heldige å få Dag Erling Smørgran til å komme og fortelle om noe han har holdt på med I det siste. Han jo en mann som har jobbet mye med fri programvare og vært en av koreutviklerne I FriBSD. Jobbet mye med Varnish, var det vel?
Ja, det også.
Og jobber I dag på Lintro. Som utvikler der. Han har jo vært et kjent ansikt I flyprogrammarmiljøet I Norge. Jeg vet ikke hvor lang tid vi skal...
10 år?
10 år, ja.
Sånn cirka.
Jeg må innrømme at som leder I NU, så har jeg stadig vekk pirket bort I Dag Erling til å komme, få han til å komme og fortelle om noe interessant. Han får stort sett blanke ark og mulighet til å fylle inn hva han skal snakke om selv. Jeg har noe interessant hver eneste gang.
Jeg har 3 sånne støpetingdingser og en liten isbjørn. Så det vel 4 ganger så langt, tror jeg.
Så vær så god, Dag Erling Smørgran.
Takk. Ja, først en liten en kort kommentar på norsk, og det at jeg vant med å presentere på engelsk. Det ikke fordi jeg ikke kan norsk, som dere hører, men det fordi etter 10-12 år I open source, og med å jobbe med stort sett folk som ikke snakker norsk, så... blir man rett og slett så bygger man seg opp et ordforråd på engelsk som man ikke bygger seg opp på norsk. Derfor finner jeg det mer behagelig å holde foredrag på engelsk. Hvis det noen her som ikke kan engelsk, så beklager jeg veldig mye. Men det... Ja. Hei, Trond. Okay. Good morning. And, well, fairly early. And thank you for coming. As Petter mentioned, my name is Dag Erling Smørgran. I am a senior developer at Linpro, the premier Norway's premier Linux and open source consultancy. I'm also a FreeBSD developer, and actually, yesterday was my 10th anniversary as a FreeBSD developer. So I've been at it for a while. I'm here to talk to you today about a project called Light My Fire. Specifically and in general about continuous integration in FreeBSD. So, just to make sure that we're all on the same page, I'm going to start by talking a little about what continuous integration is and how the term has developed over time. Anybody who has ever, how many of you have ever programmed or written a shell script or anything? Pretty much everybody, yeah. So you're all familiar with the edit compile test cycle. You write your program, you write some code, you compile it if it's a compiled language, and you test it, and it doesn't work. So you go back, you edit it, you compile it, you test it, and it still doesn't work, and you keep at it until it works, until it does what you want. Now these days, at least in the open source world, pretty much everybody uses version control, and that adds an extra dimension to the picture. But it's not really all that different. You check out your code from the repository, you edit, compile, test, and you check it back in, and that's pretty much it. It's pretty much the same thing. When you have a large project, and this is something that you don't see often, workflow is something that you don't see very often in open source, but is very common in commercial software development. You have many developers working in parallel. They're all working on a separate piece of the code, and they all work sometimes if they use a version control system that supports branching very well. Sometimes they each have their own branch that they work on, and after a set period of time. How long depends on the organization, on the project. It can be anything from a couple of days to a couple of weeks to a couple of months, actually. Once in a while, everybody takes all the code they've been working on, all the changes they've made to the application during the last development cycle, and they integrate it into the common code base, what will over time become the product. So this is integration. Of course, when you do when you integrate so much code, so many changes into your application, you have to test it very thoroughly. You do what is called an integration test, which is a series of tests, usually automated, but often not, which basically verify that all the pieces, everything that everybody has modified, all the pieces, all the modules, all the parts in your application interoperate the way they're supposed to. So your development cycle becomes edit, compile, test, check-in, integrate. With agile development, which I assume you've all heard of, it's all the rage these days. It's been all the rage for about 10 years. Instead of having this model where you have a huge integration at the end of a cycle, you get something closer to this model, or an even closer loop, where you edit, compile, test, and then you immediately, once you've tested, once you're certain that your code works, or reasonably certain that your code works, you check it in to your repository immediately. So, in effect, it is immediately integrated. You never have this huge kind of funnel there where everything is integrated into your application. You integrate everything immediately, and this is what is called continuous integration. This is the origin of the term. It is actually one of the cornerstones of agile development. It wouldn't be agile if everybody had to work separately and then synchronize at fairly large intervals. So how does this apply to FreeBSD? FreeBSD has, and most open source projects have pretty much always worked like this. They've always used continuous integration. This is, you could say, mostly because open source projects tend to be fairly unstructured, at least the ones that are volunteer-driven, large volunteer collaboration projects such as FreeBSD. So it's very hard to make this kind of people follow a schedule, follow a plan. They scratch their itch. They do what they feel like doing, and hopefully it advances your project. If it doesn't, you fire them, or you deny them access to your repository. So continuous integration is pretty much a fact of life, a fixture of open source development. However, there is one aspect of continuous integration that is rarely seen in open source. It is becoming more and more common in large projects. For instance, the Mozilla project does it a lot. I would imagine that OpenOffice also does it a lot, and that's the testing part of continuous integration. Because, as you recall, continuous integration is not just a matter of continuously integrating your code, it is also a matter of continuously performing your integration tests. Every time you integrate, you test. This is not something that has been, there isn't really a strong tradition of testing, or at least not of automated testing in the FreeBSD project. People, individual developers have their individual workflows. Some of them are very rigorous. Some of them test, especially large changes. People working on the network stack, for instance, they will perform extensive benchmarks and function tests. They will validate their code. They will verify interoperability with other implementations, etc. They will run extensive benchmarks, compare before and after. Does this code actually improve the network stack, or does it reduce performance? Things like that. But that's very, that really varies from developer to developer. People working on smaller changes usually don't do that. They test manually. And so often you find, you will often see somebody making a follow-up commit shortly after they've checked in some work, some larger changes. A day or two later, they will make a follow-up commit because something hadn't been tested sufficiently. However, and luckily, there is a clear tendency towards automated testing also in the FreeBSD project. We now have a growing number of unit tests and regression tests and micro benchmarks actually in the repository, in the source tree, although they are not run the way you're supposed to do it with continuous integration, at least according to the doctrine of agile programming, extreme programming. You're supposed to always run your tests, of course, the idea is that the testing is an integrated part of the build process, so that when you compile, you type make and it compiles your code and it tests it right away. It's not a separate act. The testing is not something that you have to start manually. I think that you'll find that the community in which this is the Perl, you'll find that the Perl community has been doing this for a very long time, for I don't know, 10 years, probably more than 10 years. Pretty much any Perl module that you can download from CPAN has a number of unit tests and regression tests. And if you use the CPAN shell to install a Perl module, or even if you download the Perl module and you run the make file, it will always run the tests before it installs, after it has. Well, Perl isn't usually not compiled, but sometimes there are compiled elements. So, the centerpiece of this presentation is that I have been working for not quite 10 years, but at least 8 years or so, to try to change this piece by piece. It wasn't something that I did very consciously at first, but I've become more and more involved and it has become more and more important for me to automate testing of FreeBSD. So there is a tipping point in any large software project, any large open source project, any large commercial project. There is a tipping point when the code base becomes so large, the application becomes so complex, large and complex, that no single developer can comprehend the entire application. Nobody can build a complete model of the entire application in their heads. It's just too big. So they know the little part of it that they're working on, and maybe a few weeks later, a few months later, they're working on a different part, and after you've worked on a different part for a couple of months, you actually forget what you knew about the other part that you were working on previously. This is something that happens all the time, because you really focus, you really focus very hard, very, very deep. You go very deeply into the code that you're working on, and it basically pushes everything else out of your mind. So I won't say that this, I had 1999 there, and I'm not trying to say that FreeBSD reached that tipping point in 1999, because FreeBSD is a huge code base, something like 8 million lines of code, I think. I don't remember the exact number, but it's a very large amount of code. But what did happen in 1999 was that FreeBSD got support for the DEC Alpha processor, which some of you may have heard of. It's defunct now, after Alpha was acquired by Compaq, which was acquired by Hewlett-Packard, etc. The reason why this is such an important date in the history of the FreeBSD project is that at that point, since most of the developers had until then, FreeBSD had been exclusively an Intel operating system, i386 operating system. And most developers only had i386 hardware. There was a very small group of developers who had access to alpha hardware. So you add to the fact that no developer knows the entirety of the system, you add to that fact the fact that most developers can't even if they want to, they can't test it. They can't test the entire system on alpha. And there are significant differences between the i386 and the alpha. The first one being that the alpha is a 64-bit platform, and the second one being that the alpha does not allow unaligned accesses, which means that you actually have to care about how you access memory on an Intel platform. You do what you want. Basically, you have a piece of memory there, you access, you want to read 32 bits from it, fine, you want to read 8 bits from it, fine, you do what you want. But on the alpha platform, if you want to read 8 bits from memory, you have to read 64 bits or 32 bits, I don't remember exactly, and then extract those 8 bits that you want. And those 32 bits, you have to address them on a 32-bit boundary. So you have to pay a lot of attention to how you lay out your structures in memory, especially in the kernel. You get a TCP packet, you get an IP packet with a TCP packet inside it. And maybe the IP header is correctly aligned, but the TCP header may not be correctly aligned. It is, because the IP header is always a multiple, the length of the IP header is always a multiple of 32 bits. But you have things like that happening. So what happens is that the i386 developers, they don't care about that. They write code, they don't even notice that something is wrong. They write code that performs unaligned accesses, and they commit it, and somebody tries to run it on the alpha, and it breaks. From the point of view of the i386 developer, everything is fine. From the point of view of the alpha developer, the i386 developers really don't give a shit about all the work I've done to port FreeBSD to the alpha, etc., etc. So of course it generates a lot of tension, a lot of friction. Very often, i386 developers would commit something to the tree that didn't even compile on the alpha, although it compiled fine on the i386. I did that several times. And after getting yelled at by alpha developers one time too many, what I did was that I wrote a script around 2000 or 2001. I don't quite remember, because I didn't have it in CVS at first. So this is the final version of that script that I abandoned in 2003. We'll get to that later. I wrote a script that simply ran in a loop on an alpha server that we had in the FreeBSD cluster that was available to all developers. What it does is simply check out the FreeBSD source code, the entire tree, and it compiles it. And if that doesn't work, it sends me an email. So at that point, it's still not perfect, because I commit my change, and then I get an email if the change I committed was wrong, the patch I committed was wrong. So it's still not ideal. Ideally, I should be able to compile it first, but I didn't have an alpha, and FreeBSD didn't really cross-build very well in those days. Okay, computer, there. This is how I called it Tinderbox script. There's I don't know if you'll call it a tradition or. Yeah, let's call it a tradition. There is a tradition of calling this kind of software, of naming it something that has to do with fire. So a tinderbox, a matchbox, there's software development groupware system called Smolder, for instance. So you can tell there's a theme there. So it's very simple. It's just one computer. It runs the tinderbox in a loop. It sends me email if something fails, and it also copies the log file to my homepage, to my web page, so that other people can easily look at it. This is what one of those emails looked like. And so after a while, I started sending I started sending these emails to the FreeBSD current mailing list, which all developers are at least they're supposed to read it. Many don't because it's very high traffic. The interesting thing is that a lot of developers got very angry at me for that. Apparently, they didn't like being told that they had made a mistake, and they probably also didn't want to be told about other people's mistake. That's not my problem. It's somebody else's problem. I don't want to hear about it. So for a while, I actually had to stop sending out these emails because people were very angry about it. Eventually, they got used to it. And actually, these days, we used to say when somebody commits a patch that that doesn't compile, we used to say that they broke the build. These days, we say they break the tinderbox, actually. So in 2003, I realized that the script I had running on that computer was far too simplistic. It didn't go nearly far enough, especially because in the meantime, we had ported FreeBSD to to many more platforms. We had the Itanium, we had the Spark 64, the Ultra Spark. We started working on the AMD 64. So I started working on a new version that runs in a more organized fashion. There are three dedicated servers for it. Each one of them runs a supervisor, which is the TB master process. The TB master runs one or more tinderbox processes, and the tinderbox process is what actually builds, checks out, and compiles the tree. It will normally run one of these processes per CPU in the machine, and it sends out an email if something is wrong. And then I have a fourth machine that will just copy very, very simply. It's not really integrated at all. It will just rsync the log files and create a summary web page, which is this. Which, well, looks kind of okay. You can see that somebody did something very bad there because it's red. Red means failure. Everything else is green across the board. The point of my previous slide, by the way, is that the servers that I run the tinderbox on are donated, maintained, and hosted by Centex, which is incredibly generous of them. This is what a tinderbox log looks like today. On the previous slide, you see the... if you look closely, you'll see that I've... one of these, the i386 current. This is what exactly that log file looks like. You can see it's not very... How many of you actually understand that? Right, one, two, three. It's not very... Well, it's kind of obscure, impenetrable. But it's a lot better than the complete log file, because the complete log file is something like, what does it say here? The complete log file is 10.6 megabytes. So actually, the tinderbox script extracts the important parts from the log file. It recognizes a compiler error, and so it will log the error from the compiler and a few lines before the error and everything that comes after it. This was actually the hardest part of the entire tinderbox, how to extract and present the information in a fairly understandable manner that took a disproportionate amount of time and effort. So this is a committer who has broken the tinderbox. So we give him the pointy hat and he goes sit on the chair and he writes, "I will be good" on the blackboard. So here we are in 2008, and it's becoming increasingly clear that my tinderbox script is far too limited. I'm going to go back once again. Going to go back to this web page, and you'll see. I don't know if you can read the dates, but you'll see that it's building 9 different branches. This one is the current development branch, and all of the others are currently supported releases or currently supported stable branches. And the thing is that most of them change very rarely. These, for instance, 6.1, 6.2, 6.3, these are release branches, and so is 5.5. They change maybe once a month. Somebody commits to those branches maybe once a month, because nobody, actually nobody is allowed to commit to those branches except for the security officer. If somebody finds a security hole in FreeBSD 5.5, for instance, the security officer will create a patch, they will send out an advisory, they will commit that patch, and then we'll actually have a change in that branch. But still, the Tinderbox builds it twice a day. Every one of those branches builds them twice a day, which is an enormous waste of CPU power that could be used for something much more useful. Sorry, if am I speaking too softly? Is that okay in the back? So, having thought about it for about at least a year, I had been planning in my mind, thinking about how the Tinderbox should be, and I started working on it. Finally, started working on it in January. This is a preview of the next generation FreeBSD Tinderbox. It's called Light My Fire. Again, there is the fire theme, and I didn't want to call it Tinderbox again because everybody else calls their system Tinderbox. Mozilla calls it Tinderbox. We even have a separate FreeBSD Tinderbox because we have a Tinderbox for the FreeBSD port system, which is very confusing, which is a completely different code base. I've never even looked at it. It's very confusing. So I called it Light My Fire. I was listening to The Doors at the time, as you can imagine. Now, the premise of Light My Fire is entirely different because for the first time, Light My Fire is actually intended to be a true continuous integration tool. What does that mean? That means that it will not only first, it will not only compile the code, but at least I hope that within the year, I will also have code in place to have it run tests as far as to the extent possible. So, still doesn't work. It's supposed to be wireless, but apparently, so if I just give me a second. I have to tell you, by the way, that as you probably understood, this is far from finished. I'm working on the code. It's still very much a work in progress, and it will be months at least before it is ready for production. So, I want a system, I want a complete continuous integration tool for FreeBSD. So we have to look at what do we actually need? What are the requirements for such a system? Oh, now it works. In roughly in order of importance, the first requirement is coverage. This is something that we already have in the existing system. It means that we need to build as much of the code as possible. We need to build, every time something changes in one of the branches, we need to build it, to compile it, and hopefully to test it, if possible. And we need to build it for every platform that FreeBSD supports to the extent possible. Currently, I think the only thing that's missing right now is that we have two platforms which are fairly experimental, and we don't have a default kernel configuration for them. So I can build the userland, but I can't build the kernel for those. Apart from that, I think that the Tinderbox builds pretty much everything. So this is coverage. The second requirement is consistency. The current Tinderbox, the script that actually checks out and builds the code, it's not very different in principle from the first version that was a shell script. The innovation of the 2003 version was the supervisor script and the nice looking HTML summary and all that stuff. Why is this a problem? It's a problem because it takes about, I think, 8 hours for a complete build, a complete build run of FreeBSD current on AMD 64 ARM i386, Spark 64, etc., etc., etc. And during those 8 hours, some people will commit changes that break the build. And so you'll have a build run that starts nicely, everything is green, and then in the middle of the row, you start having red entries. The build fails. And they'll notice this, hopefully they'll notice it pretty quickly. They'll see the email that's sent out to the list or something, or whatever. They notice it, they fix it, and suddenly the build is green again, which is very impractical, because the point of building building the source tree for every platform that we support is precisely what was my initial motivation. Sometimes you commit something that works on one platform but not on another. So when you see green, 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 red, green, 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 you think, oh, somebody broke that platform. And very often it is not the case. Usually when somebody actually does break the build, they'll break every platform. It's fairly rare that they break only one of the platforms. So we need to be consistent. When we start a build run or an iteration, when we decide, okay, now we're going to build current on every platform that we support, we need to check out a copy of the source tree, and we need to use that same single copy for every single build. It may seem obvious, but with the current setup, it's not that easy to do, because the builder script is self-contained. So there's no way to tell it that, hey, the source code has already been checked out. It's right there. Just use that. Don't check out your own copy. And actually, there are additional advantages to checking out a single copy of the source tree. If you have multiple builds of the same version running in parallel on the same computer, having only one copy of the source tree instead of two improves cache locality. It reduces the amount of data that you have to cache, so actually the build runs much faster. Which is one of my other requirements, which we will get to later. Still, there is one thing that checking out a single copy of the source code will not fix, and that is FreeBSD still uses CVS. CVS tracks history separately for each file. It doesn't support atomic commits. It doesn't lock the repository very well. So it is entirely possible, and it happens fairly often, that you check out, you update your source tree, and you get something that, you get an inconsistent result, because you check out the source tree at the exact same time that somebody is checking in a change, and you get only part of their change instead of getting the entire change. So it doesn't compile, or it doesn't run, or whatever. This is something that we can't fix without switching to a different version control system. So the third requirement is persistence. This is something, actually, I think that I presented it. I don't remember if it was Noog or if it was a different Unix user group in Norway, but in 2003, I think, way back in 2003, I had a similar presentation about the Tinderbox, where I demonstrated some code that I had prototyped for the current version. It goes through the log file, and it adds markup. It converts the log file to HTML with links everywhere. So you see a file name in the log file, you click on that, and you get the source file that it refers to. You see an error message in your log file, you click on the error message, and you get not only the file that it refers to, but it scrolls down, immediately scrolls down to the line where the build failed, the line that the compiler is complaining about. This is very useful. This is much more useful than just sending out an email, because, well, you send out an email, there's a link at the bottom of the email, and the developers can click on that link, and they get the log, and they click on the error message, and there's your bug. You see it immediately. You immediately see why it's not building. The reason why I never deployed this is precisely persistence. In order to deploy something like this in production, you have to keep a copy of the source tree long enough that that you actually have time to go through the log and click and look at everything, etc. So when you're continuously building and you're continuous every time you build for a new platform, you update your source tree. So the source tree is no longer consistent with the log file that you're looking at, which is why I never deployed that code. This is one of the things that Light My Fire will correct by storing the source tree that was used for a particular iteration, maybe for a week or so. You can go through the log of previous iterations and, oh, it broke there. 3 days ago, the tree broke. I'm going to look at that log and I'm going to look at the source code. Or maybe the last iteration, it broke today. So let's look at the log. Let's look at the source code without running into the problem of having the source code move under your feet. The reason why I didn't do this previously, keep a separate copy of the source tree around, was primarily disk space. The original Tinderbox servers were basically recycled servers that had been used for something else and weren't useful for that purpose anymore. So they had, I think they had maybe 10 gigabytes of disk. They had barely enough disk space for their intended purpose. I didn't have room to copy that. But disks are cheap these days. They're incredibly cheap. I have 2 terabytes of storage under my desk at home. And I'm sure that many of you have too. So this is not a problem anymore. And especially when you only have one source tree for the entire iteration, you basically slash your disk space requirements by to 1/8 of what you would have with the old system. The fourth requirement is economy. I already mentioned the problem with building code that hasn't changed, and basically this is what economy is about. Don't build anything that you don't need to build. The difficulty there is that you have to actually know that you need to build something and that you don't need to build something. And again, due to the limitations of CVS, this is actually fairly hard or time consuming. But I'll find a way to do it. A consequence, by the way, of determining whether something has changed is that you can also determine who changed it. So if one build succeeds and the next build breaks, you have a list of people who committed changes in the meantime, and you can send them an email saying, hey, I'm not sure it was you, but it was one of you guys, and here's the log. Okay. Their fifth requirement is speed. Economy and speed kind of overlap, because obviously when you implement the economy requirement, you have less to do, so the build goes faster. Reducing the workload is always good. But FreeBSD current always changes. It's always a moving target. Even on Christmas Eve, people will commit something to current. So you always have to build current. Therefore, you can't rely just on reducing the amount of builds you have to run. You want to reduce the amount of work that each build needs to do. And one of the ways to do that is the way the Mozilla people do it, is to run incremental builds. Instead of building everything from scratch, they keep the result of the previous build around, and they update the source tree, and they run a build with the dependency system, etc., so it doesn't rebuild anything that hasn't changed. This usually works. Sometimes it doesn't. FreeBSD when you build FreeBSD, it starts by building the tools that it needs to build itself. It's basically self-bootstrapping. And sometimes if you make some sort of very subtle changes to the make files or to some of the part of the build infrastructure, you won't be able to actually perform an incremental build from one version to the next. You will have to build from scratch. But that's okay. We can live with that. If the build fails, we do a full build the next time, so we're sure that wasn't the problem. There's one thing that would maybe seem obvious to some people that we can't do, and that's running parallelizing the build. The FreeBSD build can be parallelized. You can, if let's say you have 8 CPUs in your computer, you type make -j8, and it will partition the work over your 8 CPUs. The problem is that the log file becomes completely incomprehensible because it's not linear anymore. Everything is just jumbled together. So it's very useful when you want to build something that you know works and you just want to build it fast. It's completely useless, or at least not so useful, when you're actually trying to figure out if something works or not. Granularity is an attempt to increase the amount of information that we get from each build. Because currently, since we build everything linearly, we stop at the first error we get, we stop. This is how make works. It stops immediately when it hits an error. The problem with that is that you could have 4 different bugs in your source tree, and you only get to know about one of them. You want to know about them all, or at least as many of them as possible. So the idea is to try to figure out which parts of the tree are dependent on each other. So if one part of the tree breaks, you know that this part, and that part, they have a dependency to the part on the part that broke, so you can't build them. But you can still build the rest of the tree, or at least try to, and maybe you'll find another error somewhere. This actually isn't as hard to do as it sounds. I've done it for the ports tree, and it's actually easier to do for the source tree than the ports tree, because the ports tree has a much more complex build system. The 7th and final requirement is flexibility. Now, the reason why I mentioned flexibility last is not because it's the least important. It's actually because it's the most important. So this is what the rest of my presentation is about. Everything we've gone through so far, it's groundwork. It's a matter of making the tinderbox, or making Light My Fire, do what we want it to do effectively and efficiently. Flexibility is about telling it what needs to be done and actually having it do what we want it to do, instead of just a loop that keeps going and it's basically stuck in a rut. It just loops, it checks out builds. It's very dumb. If you want, with the current system, if I want to change something, if I want to add a branch or remove a branch or add a platform that I want to build or something, I have to edit the configuration file on each of the servers. I have to restart the supervisor, or at least wait until it finishes and then picks up the configuration change when it restarts. It's not very flexible. So flexibility is what justifies the entire effort. Flexibility is why the desire for flexibility is why I'm working on it. The core of the core of the system, the main reason. The way we're going to ensure that Light My Fire is flexible, that it provides us with the flexibility we want, is to have it centrally controlled. Instead of the way it is now with three independent servers, they work independently, they don't know about each other. We have a fourth server that just copies the logs, etc., everything that I told you about earlier. We're now, Light My Fire has supervising, whoops, stupid mouse, supervising server here, some kind of all-seeing eye that decides what to do, when to do it, and it tells all the little busy bees, tells them what to do and when to do it. You can also see that I've drawn many more machines than we have currently. I'm hoping to get my hands on the stash of secondhand 1U servers. So the manager, which is the main process, the brain running on the central server, the manager will communicate with each of the workers on each of the worker processes on each of the build machines. And the worker processes manage and supervise the builder processes. The right part, the right-hand part here of this sequence diagram is roughly equivalent to the current implementation, roughly. The difference here is that when the worker starts up, when one of the builder machine boots and the worker process starts, it registers itself with the manager. Why do we do it that way? It makes it a lot easier to add builder machines. I can take one out. The manager will not spend any time trying to contact a server that isn't there. If I add a new server, I won't have to tell the manager about it. The new build server just registers with the manager. Here I am. Give me some work. It will also tell the manager what it's capable of. This one has, let's say, two CPUs, so it will tell the manager, well, I have two task slots. I can do two things at the same time. So the manager says, hey, cool. I have a build for you to run. So the little green arrows, I have a build for you to run. The worker says, okay, it starts off a builder. The builder runs. But the manager knows that the worker has two slack task slots, so it says, oh, and by the way, I have another build for you to run. And the worker starts another builder. And you can see how, well, the builder reports its results to the worker reports its results to the manager, which stores everything in a database, and then sends more work, etc. This is what part of the user interface of the new system looks like. And you remember seeing the list of releases, of branches that the Tinderbox would build. We have an equivalent list here. Some of them are marked as active, some are marked as inactive. The inactive ones are the ones we don't bother building. The active ones are the ones we will actually build, and those correspond roughly to not quite as many here as on the previous one, because some of them are nearing their end of life. So this is, Light My Fire is intended to be able to work with several projects simultaneously. So this is the FreeBSD project. It has several source repositories. We don't actually care about the dock and ports repositories, but I've included them for completeness. We have the source repository, and all of these branches are they're stored in the source repository. This is the name of the branch and the description, very basic stuff. So, for the first time, we have an interactive interface that allows us to control the Tinderbox instead of having to do everything manually. I was actually going to say to my great and great shame that the FreeBSD Tinderbox is the only continuous integration tool in the world that doesn't have an interactive management system, which I've discovered to my great surprise isn't true. I've seen similar systems deployed in commercial organizations that don't have a management interface, and they work very well for what they're supposed to do. So that was one burden off my chest. So how much time do we have? 10 minutes. Okay. Which means that I have time to talk to you about what I was going to talk to you, which is how the manager knows what to run and when. We have a number of repositories, we have a number of branches. What you can't see on this screenshot is are the targets that we're going, the platforms that we're going to build for. The from on the basis of those repositories, those branches, and those platforms, excuse me, we define iterations. I'm going to rewind, stupid mouse again. I'm going to rewind a bit and go back to the previous screenshot I had. I clearly should have put them in a different order. This is the summary page. You have a list of iterations, and there are no currently running iterations, and no iterations have recently ended. An iteration is a bunch of of builds. You select one branch, and you have a bunch of platforms that you're going to build. The reason why I have divided iterations into branches instead of having one iteration that builds everything is the fact that sometimes branches don't change. Very often branches don't change. So how do these branches? How are those branches defined? We have a branch. Those iterations defined. We have an iteration template. And the iteration template has information about how are you going to define your iteration. You're going to build running FreeBSD 5.0, highly unlikely because it's completely defunct, but for the sake of the argument. We want to build it. Every time it changes, you will put that at the top of your queue. There is also information in the template about about timing. For instance, you may want to run this precisely once a day, or maybe you want to run it as often as possible, or maybe this is something that is so important that when it occurs, when this iteration shows up in the schedule, you want to put everything else aside and do only this. Why? Because one of the features that I've actually wanted to add to the Tinderbox for a very long time, which is possible in the current implementation, but very inconvenient to actually do, is the ability to test a patch. The current system is very reactive. It will pick up what has already been done and test it. There is no way to test something that hasn't been committed yet. So you're in a situation, I told you about the release branches, right? They change very rarely. And they only change when we get when we find a security hole or a very serious bug, and we fix that bug, and we send out an advisory, etc. And we need to test that in advance, because if we send out an advisory with a patch and we haven't tested it thoroughly enough, then egg on our faces. Everybody's going to yell at us, and we have to send out a new advisory, and it's very embarrassing. And we get something like the Black Summer of 2001 or something, where we just had security hole after security hole after security hole. There was an open SSL exploit. There was it was unbelievable. We basically spent the entire summer just fixing security holes from third party applications. So the idea is that the security officers will have ability and the access to upload a patch and say, okay, we need a high priority iteration. We absolutely must have this patch tested on this branch, on this platform, or on all platforms immediately. This is top priority. We put everything else aside and we do just this. On the sly, most likely in a situation where the security officer requests an iteration, we don't actually want people who are just visiting the website to know about it. Simply because Very often, when we get information, for instance, from MITRE or from CERT about a security hole, there is very often an embargo on that information. We're not allowed to talk about it. We're not even allowed to hint about it until a specific date. And this is because you're supposed to give the author of the software, if it's a third-party package, you're supposed to give them time to actually develop a patch, and everybody will release their advisories in a coordinated fashion, etc. So we need a way to test this without unobtrusively. Yeah, he already told. Yeah. There are other cases, not quite as dramatic as the security hole example. For instance, Andre Opperman, he's been doing a lot of. And Robert Watson have been doing a lot of performance work on the network stack, and those are huge patches, and they work on them in a separate repo. And well, there you are. It's not continuous integration. You have a huge patch that you want to integrate. So let's test it on the Tinderbox ahead of time to make sure that it builds on everything we have before we commit it. Obviously, this is not something that we want to do for every single committer whenever they feel like, because then the Tinderbox wouldn't be, or LightMyFire wouldn't be doing anything else than testing patches, and it's not supposed to spend all of its time testing patches. It's supposed to actually build the stuff. I mentioned multiple projects earlier. Here you see an example of a Varnish iteration that has been entered into the system. This is something that the previous Tinderbox was obviously not able to do. It was very, very FreeBSD focused. It only knows how to build FreeBSD. You have to run make in this specific fashion, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't run configure or anything. So this is one of the things I also really want to do. This requires having different versions of the builder script. We need to have a builder script that knows about the new auto tools. You need to run AT local and autoconf, automake, etc., libtilize, whatever. You need to run the configure script, maybe with some arguments. And this is very different from the way FreeBSD is built. So we still send out email, maybe in a different form than previously, but we will still have that. And obviously, we have the web interface. A little further, I don't think I have time for this, but I actually wanted to talk a little about my, let's say, that castle on the horizon. All the things that I would really, really like to do, but I they're not highly, they're not a high priority, and they will take a lot of work to do. So maybe, you know, maybe someday, maybe if wishes were horses, etc. But instead, I'm going to open for questions, if there are any. Yes.
My name is Patricia. I work for Opera Software. Mm-hmm. We have a similar system. The question that I had is that you said saving the source tree for later so that you could do lookups regarding the error. We tag the tree. And so then you can check out the source on the tag, or you can use some kind of online CVS doc tool to see the file on that tag. And is there a reason why I didn't choose that kind of solution?
Okay, so the question is, why do we not tag the tree every time we want to run an iteration, right? Several reasons. First of all, we don't want, looking at the big picture, with let's say I want to use it for both FreeBSD and Varnish, I don't want to assume that I actually have access, especially write access, to the repositories. Doing that would require actually the Tinderbox script, which maybe, or the manager, which maybe runs as a user www on the server, something like that, would actually have to have an SSH key and write access to the repo. And if the web server is compromised, that could be catastrophic. The second reason, which is actually, I think, far more important, at least for FreeBSD, is that CVS handles tagging very, very poorly. Very, very poorly. It takes a lot of time to tag a CVS repository, and you have to lock the tree while you do it. Nobody can commit. So actually, for FreeBSD, it's not an option at all. But what I do intend to do is that I will, when I check out a source tree for an iteration, I don't check out this very second. I check out the beginning of this hour, or maybe the beginning of the day, or something, depending on how often I run the build. And this is, of course, stored in the database. I have a list of source trees. They each have a UUID, and they have the name of the branch and the either the tag or the date that I use to check out. So it is reproducible. Other questions? Yes.
How about piggybacking on the work that CPAN is doing, virtualized testing, CPAN at home and stuff like that? That would really...
Okay, the question is why not piggyback on the virtualized testing that CPAN has been doing?
Maybe that's the next stage.
There is... When we test, which we don't do yet, when we actually run regression tests and everything, I don't think that running them in virtual machines is a very good idea because many of the tests we actually want to run are micro benchmarks. Not because we think that micro benchmarks in themselves say very much about the performance of the system, but if from one iteration to another, you get a different result for one of the benchmarks, and that result is dramatically worse than the previous iteration, then you can raise a flag and say, there's something wrong here. With the virtualized testing, if that's what you mean, a testing in a virtual machine, you can't really conclude anything because the virtual machine does not have, sometimes it will have more resources than other times. So of course, yeah, regression tests, unit tests, you can do that in a virtual machine, but micro benchmarks, et cetera, I think that we'll be forced to do the testing on a real machine. And currently, I have enough trouble getting hardware to run the builds on. I also have to get hardware to run the tests on. I don't need as much CPU power, obviously, for running tests as for building. But still, you have to get the hardware to do it. If I compile a Spark 64 version of FreeBSD,